If you believe in what we do, now's the time to support it. Whether you're renewing your subscription or joining us for the very first time, it starts at a minimum of just $5 a month. Way less than a streaming subscription, but far more impactful. This is a membership drive. I'm Ace Estwick, and I serve on KPFK's local station board. Please call 818-985-5735, then press option 2, or visit kpfk.org and click donate now. Let's build the future together.
This is Ed Begley Jr., and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's program, we look at how tech capital is reshaping American politics. The Democratic Party is reeling after its defeat by Trump, with pundits blaming poor messaging. But my guest, political scientist Thomas Ferguson, argues the problem goes much deeper. Democrats didn't fail to persuade. They failed to deliver for most Americans. Ferguson is best known for his investment theory of politics, and he says U.S. democracy is dominated by big money, with ordinary people pushed to the margins unless they have strong organizations behind them. He and his co-authors show that under Biden, wages rose modestly, but inflation and lost hours erased those gains, while the wealthy walked away with soaring assets, a dual or K-shaped recovery, and we'll explain that. And at the same time, Ferguson points to the rise of what he calls red tech, a new convergence of Silicon Valley, defense, finance, and crypto, increasingly shaping both parties. Tech firms push deregulation and see unions as obstacles, while crypto and finance tech, or fintech, enjoy bipartisan support. The result, Ferguson argues, is a Democratic Party trapped between donors and working people and a structural impasse. We're going to talk about what this means for the future of labor, for state experiments, for foreign policy priorities, and for the prospects of keeping democracy. We'll do all this when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman, and very happy to have Tom Ferguson back with us today. We're going to set the political context. The Democratic Party's in disarray after its loss to Trump, with low approval ratings, internal conflicts, failure to connect with working class issues and concerns. And Tom attributes much of the current crisis to big money influence and the economic failures under the Biden administration. U.S. politics is dominated by big money, and only the wealthy donors can afford real influence, meaning ordinary people are sidelined and grassroots groups are either too weak or sometimes donor-controlled. We're going to unpack all of that and more. So let me welcome Tom and just give our listeners a little bit more about you. Tom Ferguson is the research director at INED, or the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He's professor emeritus at UMass Boston and a member of the Academic Advisory Board of Better Markets. He's the author of, or co-author of, several books. And we've talked about some of them right here, including Golden Rule and Right Turn. And his articles appear pretty much everywhere, but including the Quarterly Journal of Economics, International Organization, International Studies Quarterly, and the Journal of Economic History. And Tom's also a member of the editorial board of the International Journal of Political Economy, and I think still a contributing editor to The Nation.
I am, though. I think they haven't had me contribute in a long time, and I think are probably pretty happy with that.
Well, yeah,
I'm on the Boston Review contributing.
Oh, Boston Review. That's really good. Okay. Well, thanks for all of that. Welcome to the show. Let's just start with the Democrats' crisis since Trump, you know, has returned. Democrats are anguishing over their message problem, but you've argued that they failed to materially deliver for working people, and you've done the work to show the evidence. Let's get some of that.
Look, it's pretty simple. All through the Biden administration, the mainline Democrats, including a lot of people who called themselves progressives, kept saying this was the most pro-worker administration since, they kind of forgot Harry Truman, but they would say, you know, Roosevelt or something like that. The claim was repeated over and over. And folks, even there were a number, a string of people, David Albert, Aaron Dube, and these folks, they were purporting to prove that there was this huge change in labor markets that was coming as a result of policy, and that this was a big change in the previous patterns, and the workers were finally, as it were, get something, to put it somewhat carelessly, out of the system. It took me about a minute when I looked around. I mean, I just look, come on. But my colleague Servaas Storm and I looked at this in a series of articles, and it was obviously not true. I mean, this to this day, I find almost unfathomable the way, and Paul Krugman repeated these claims too, and he kept repeating them. You know, but anybody should have been able to deflate the nominal wages by the price level and get a real wage level. And then the other side of it, the point that Storm and I kept making over and over was, hey, working hours are actually falling. So real weekly wages are falling. And I mean, there was an early on compositional effect. You know, you may remember in the worst days of COVID, what a lot of employers did is they let everybody go. They laid them off and they kept the highest paid workers. So the averages went up a little bit just from that. It's a composition effect. As soon as folks came back on, it, you know, they went right back. They're just never, we actually kept putting this out in a series of papers. They'd run as iNet working papers, and then two of the three appeared in, you know, scholarly journals. We just sort of walked you through this again and again. And boy, did people not want to talk about this. And the other point we made, despite, you know, in other words, wages aren't, you know, you're not having a huge wage rise, was that the quantitative easing program of the Federal Reserve, which, you know, they've been doing that in various guises actually since the first great financial crisis in the wake of that 2008, but they were slowly trying to taper that off in the last 3 or 4 years before COVID hit. But as soon as COVID hit, they went back to that. I mean, that effectively, you just put the interest rates at zero. That just supercharged both the housing market and stock markets. And the result was securities markets, which in the jump, when people just made out like bandits, if you had the money. I mean, we were, you know, using, you know, that radical source, the Federal Reserve statistics on wealth. They were publishing wealth statistics. And I remember looking at this. I said to myself, you know what? These are incredible numbers. Now, let's just take the old estimates of how much you spend out of wealth, which are relatively small. They're very tiny amounts. They're not a lot. And just run it through on these numbers. And it was just astounding. So the Storm and I looked at this stuff and said, you know what? This is quite incredible. Though you're seeing an epical increase in wealth. And you know what? They were spending more and more out of this. And we kept saying this in three different papers. And at one point, a guy from the New York Times called me up, was interested in this. He wouldn't print it. You know, he just did not want to talk about it. But now, suddenly, since the Trump folks came in, the Democrats have switched their line. I now realize that's coming from the Senate Democrats, Senator Warren's operation. And Bloomberg and other people are writing up what they're calling the K-shaped economy, and they're talking a lot about this. I was actually in a meeting not too long ago with Mark Zandi and these people at Moody, and I just said, well, I'm glad your guys have sort of noticed, but we were saying this 3 years ago, and that's just a fact. Now, this is still important because there is a view, the official Democrats are putting out what might be called the son or daughter of the greatest party for you since FDR, their version is that Biden left a wonderful economy and that Trump is ruining. What Biden left was this huge K-shaped economy. It's plain as day. We have the numbers there in those articles. It's in the International Journal of Political Economy, and they're open access, actually. And this is the simple facts of the matter. Now, this is one of the basic points to understand about American politics now. As you said, yeah, I've been pushing the investment theory of parties for a long time, because it was obvious to me when I was doing lots, especially a lot of archival research, that, you were not seeing lots of popular organizations successfully pressuring for White House decision making. You were seeing lots of billionaires. You're going right at, or the smaller group, less billionaires, relatively recent, though, Rockefeller counted as one, and others. This stuff's been going on for a long time, though in different degrees, and it certainly varies a lot with the strength of unionization there, okay? Now, you're looking at very weak unionization, but my point is simply this, that that giant increase in wealth has, in some sense, I had this feeling, and I used to do it occasionally in an interview with folks, I have this bad feeling that this is maybe a tipping point. And you're looking at much larger, if you want to think of this as a ratio of wealth to the rest of the population, these numbers are crazy. I mean, they were bad before, and everybody knew this. People were writing about the second Gilded Age back in, 2012. Well, you know what? This is the Gilded Age squared. I mean, there are some numbers, we're not going to worry about decimal points. The bottom line is that, the top 10 or 15% of the population now control an enormous amount of total consumer spending. And so you got this kind of crazy closed loop right now, which is a very interesting problem. But we pose this problem in our articles, just saying, look, you have this boom going on, and then you're making the rich richer. They're spending more, not necessarily as a percentage, but because they're getting so incredibly rich, they're driving more and more consumption, which leads, you can sort of see here a kind of almost Dr. Seuss cat in a hat trick or something, where the stock market goes up, the rich get richer, consumption increases. Meantime, the rest of the population is having a lot of trouble. That is the reason the Democrats got flattened. I mean, look, the total change in the whole 4 years was a micro percentage. And that doesn't take any account of, all the times they were below. If you thought somebody was expecting, say, they were kind of hoping for maybe 1.5% real wage increase. They didn't think in these terms, but per year. The shortfall and the disappointment on the Democrats is palpable.
Well, let me just come in for a second, because I want you to go back and actually elaborate on what you're just saying, Tom Ferguson. But just in terms of the perception, I think one reason that people thought Biden was so different is that, in fact, from what came before, it was the first time, you saw an administration with a form of redistributive politics that you saw in the BBB, the Build Back Better. But that got crushed by Manchin and Sinema and the Republicans, so it didn't go through. And then through the Inflation Reduction Act, they got a few little things through. But I think also the other part of it is that at the beginning of the pandemic, there was all of this talk about essential workers, and they were dying. Fast food workers, Amazon workers, and others, thanks to Bernie on that one, saw their minimum wage go up to $15. And then there was a shortage, and so there was a competition for these workers. And that, I think, gave a perception that wage growth was really good. And you knocked that down, in your work. So maybe it's a question of perception versus reality.
Well, I don't actually think there ever was a perception versus reality problem. That is to say, most people, when you look at, and we should say we're talking about principally about an interview I did in Jacobin, and I noticed there's a misprint in one thing there, where it's the polls are looking good until January of 2022, and somehow it's probably my fault. I'm not blaming anybody but myself. That says 2021. The Biden administration did very well on it coming in on aid. They cut that back very fast, in my opinion, way too fast. And so they were cutting back on this stuff all through 2022, right as the election's approaching. It's not easy to understand, the elementary, even electoral logic of that. The other problem I had, and I'm not the only one who had it, was their COVID response. We know now, it's printed in an interview with Philip Alvelda on the INET website that I think Lynn Paramore did, where it turns out that Biden had some consultants telling him you should just declare victory with COVID. Well, that's not what they should have done. They wasted a lot of time and money not addressing ventilation. I mean, it's my biggest single disappointment with them was the way they sort of blew the health stuff on that. They should have insisted on ventilation standards everywhere, but especially in public buildings and schools. They just didn't do it. The Alvelda stuff is probably the best on what they didn't do. Now, I thought they cut back too fast, and they were unaccountably slow in getting some of this money out, too. Like, to this day, I'm baffled by what took them so long. There's a claim around from the abundance folks that, well, they were just somehow inefficient in getting, like, rural broadband out. We know that was Republican opposition to that.
Absolutely.
Continuous to that. That's been sort of shown. You know, I think they were inexcusably slow in implementing a large chunk of this, and that didn't help. Look, the other thing people need to sort of focus on is what was the net change in unionization over the entire four-year period? It was zero. Basically, when you take a percentage of the population, percentage of the working population that's organized into unions, it's zero. That's not to say that some people didn't increase their unionization. Sometimes they did. But the net increase is just basically nothing.
And what you did see is spectacular militancy, especially in the last, you know, the LA hot summer, the UAW, yes, on various strikes. You know, they had garnered public support and were successful in that. But that's a different topic. But they weren't translated into an increase in
union. No, they weren't. And there was a huge amount of lack of interest, both in the press, but I'd say also even in the labor movement, in these many smaller demonstrations and strikes. There were lots of small strikes that mostly fall below the threshold of the federal counting. Mike Elk has a site that was counting those.
Yeah.
I used some of his data in a paper on the 2020 election. In general, the organized labor movement has been, to my opinion, quite slow to move, not easy to understand what they're all thinking either. They were also sometimes, many unions were not helpful on COVID. I mean, the movement against masking was insane among some of them. Now, Rich Trumka, when he was leading the AFL-CIO, was a coal miner, and he knew the masking mattered. After he died, I'm not seeing any great impulse on that stuff. And the Democrats weren't providing it. I have to say, look, the health policy, I do say it in the interview in the Jacobin, the Democrats could concentrate a lot more. When you start looking at life expectancy data, there's a string of papers now. Steve Wolf has some, and so do several other people, which I actually cite in the Jacobin piece. They show you that if you do it at the county level or at the state level, in Republican areas, the death rates tend to be, the life expectancy rates are just, they're worse. And the changes in life expectancy in some of those areas over the long run are simply horrible. We know that the general increase in life expectancy in the U.S. is way behind other developed countries. But people have not exploited enough the now obvious evidence of the bluntly political cognates of some of these disastrous health statistics. And it's hard for me to understand why the Democratic leadership doesn't do more about that.
Because I want to segue into your basic thesis about the dominance of money. And that tells you, and you've been saying this for a very long time,
Before it was fashionable.
It was fashionable, and I remember way back, the Center for Public Integrity at one point used to publish in every election a way to show who was going to win is to look at how much money was spent the year before the candidate, how much money was accrued, let's say. But beyond that, it explains a lot. Like you've just been talking about, why aren't the Democrats pushing unionization? Why aren't they talking about healthcare anymore the way that they did in elections prior until the Affordable Care Act was passed? And your theory is that money spent is dominating the way that politics change. And we saw this pivot in the Harris campaign, right? And you saw that Kamala Harris started out
ridiculous in the Harris campaign.
Right, and she starts
embarrassing.
Up. Yeah, I just, she starts out, you know, with and brings in Tim Walz as her vice presidential candidate, and she's doing affordability issues. And then all of a sudden, there's this sharp pivot where she makes this disingenuous claim, oh, I love small business. And, you know, no talk about healthcare, no talk about taxes. And Mark Cuban, who is a very big donor to the Democrats, was bragging on Twitter about how he had her phone number and he bombarded her with texts about.
Reid Hoffman was doing the same thing. There were a whole string of them.
So let's talk a little bit about this, because what your thesis is that money determines everything. But I think the corollary of that is that money also pushes both parties to the right. And we can bring that in when you start talking about red tech. But let's talk a little bit just about that campaign and how you see, you know, the way that these big donors.
First of all, my colleagues and I are still working on the 2024 presidential data. You know, you don't jump off diving boards into empty swimming pools. And so I'd be a little cautious, but I've seen enough of the numbers that it's perfectly obvious that lots of tech folks really did like Harris, were much cooler toward Biden. And Harris, I'm baffled why she, now you wouldn't count this woman as exactly a tech person, but she's much closer to them than when Harris was campaigning in the last couple of weeks with Liz Cheney instead of Sanders through the Midwest. I thought, what on earth are you thinking? I don't know what they were thinking, but for sure they didn't want to think about Sanders. And that was probably the main driving force, if I had to guess. You know, we have an incomplete record on that campaign, and Harris has a new book out that I haven't read, but is apparently letting rather a lot of things slide that people out that people hadn't talked about. But my sense of that was she wasn't particularly comfortable with the labor folks, even though her labor record in California was not horrible. I'm not trying to say she didn't have time. She did. But the labor folks don't seem to me to have been asking for very much either, that I can tell. But in any case, if I may add a friendly amendment, I don't think money determines everything. Where it gets very powerful is where the popular organization is super weak. And that right now you're looking at historically very low levels of popular organization, either labor unions, community organizations. There are exceptions. Everybody knows about Los Angeles and Hispanic organizations, for example. You've just seen that again. But that's uncommon. There aren't many cases of that. And so, yeah, money talks when nothing else can squawk.
But particularly at the leadership level of the Democratic Party, because now you have this Democratic Party in angst over why they lost and what their message should be. And also even in wanting to endorse Mamdani, who clearly shows, as Sanders did, where the base is and what are winning strategies. But that does the donors. It's anathema to the donors.
It doesn't take a genius to realize that people are really terrified about health care, especially as they're looking at very large rises in Obamacare premium and, you know, the cutbacks now in Medicaid. People are also nervous about Social Security, I think mostly because they can't quite sort out all this garbage about how the system is said to be going broke when the system just relies on general tax authority. And you'll notice there are not many people in the Democratic Party leadership who are rushing to clarify that point. But where this shows most, where I can talk with some, I think, real authority with my colleagues, Paul Jorgensen, Maddie Sluise, and Ji Chen, we've been doing work on crypto. And in the process, developed a good database on the Democratic congressional candidates in 24, some on 22, and in the current folks. And what you see there is this enormous swelling of crypto cash. There's nothing to study in the Republican Party. There's no variation. I mean, everybody is. I mean, it's like a potlatch where everybody's got some gift already and they're just passing it around. There's no variation there. The thing to watch in the Democratic Party is the Genius Act, which supposedly secured stable coins. We'll use that in quotes. And the Genius Act, you know, it's one of those laugh a minute legislative titles. But they passed it. And last year, when it wasn't the exact same bill, but the top crypto stuff in the Democrats in the House got 42 votes. This year it got 102.
So can you explain that a little bit more clearly for us? Just the role that, because people, as you intimate, people think that crypto is a Republican thing, and you're showing it's really bipartisan, tech.
We picked up on that line for a while. Their claim was Sam Bankman-Fried was a Democrat and was all Democrat. When we produced this paper, which produced much higher numbers than anybody else had, that's always true because we're just a lot more thorough. Because the question of sorting out names and getting things is really, we don't want to talk about that here. This is like going into the weeds. But no, it's not just a Republican thing. It's now, and what you see, particularly in the last 9, 10, 11 months, and even before that, in the 2024 election, from roughly after August or so, enormous sums flowing into the Democratic leadership. That is to say, Chuck Schumer, you will be amazed to discover, took a lot of cash. And Jeffries is into it. And I'm talking about their personal PACs, the ones they, I mean, this, you know, they all have a name, leadership, this or that or something, but they're controlled by them. It's also the congressional campaign committees in the Senate and the House. This is pretty crazy stuff. And they are also contributing heavily at the state party level. This, you know, is clear to me, though we haven't published on it yet. What's essentially happening is if the top rungs of the leadership most everywhere are being sort of an unsympathetic being would say bought out. I actually think this is a pretty serious problem, and it's going to condition, because at the local levels, you can sometimes run against a lot of money with a good local organization. And you can raise some money of your own locally, and the local races won't necessarily show the giant disproportion. If you go to a national deal, and that's a totally different story. At that point, the sums involved are enormous. They're very hard to compete with. In many states, you cannot. And the other thing of this you have to remember is even in the national elections, folks who are prominent national Democrats will often in the local elections just vote Republican. I remember very well when I interviewed a guy many years ago, I was a grad student at Princeton, and I interviewed a local Republican leader, and he just said to me, well, of course, you know, George Ball, of course we know him, he was a leading Democrat. I mean, that was their local Republicans. I don't want to pay taxes at the local level. And national Democrats, that pattern, what I'm really telling you is this, in big chunks of the United States, there is no alternative local money at all if it's not coming from labor unions or community organizations. There's also a great deal of money going into local parties and local candidates that comes through the IRS, not through the Federal Election Commission. This is usually sort of headlined as a 527 money. People don't track this stuff. It's much harder. The computer programs are not the same. It just irritates me greatly that all these folks who claim to be telling you this, to have not built a simple platform for this, where my colleagues and I are sort of doing it now, but it's not wonderful. But when you look at that, you will be just astonished. I mean, I looked at some stuff in Massachusetts where that was coming in through the 527s. It's see these hundreds of thousands of dollars streaming into folks who are somewhere in the legislature, but they don't have to report it. It's not a federal campaign. It's a local story. So it doesn't show in the FEC. And people just don't see this. I mean, I watched some people. I watched one representative who was just taking in enormous sums of cash, 6 or 8 or 10 years, and then left the legislature and went to a business organization. If you don't look for that stuff, you don't see it. It's a big hole in legislative reporting. You know, don't count on the American mass media to dig this out.
They don't really explain much of it either, but I want you to go back, Tom Ferguson, and just explain a little bit more about, I guess, the attraction of crypto and finance, and explain, is this really, you know, sort of because the Republicans want to do away with regulation? And as you say, the abundance folks, you know, are talking about it in a way that somehow is more palatable to Democrats, but is essentially the same thing. So can you talk a little bit about that in relation to finance and tech and your aversion to unions?
Yeah, we need to get to red tech, and we'll just generalize it this way. We know tech's been developing for a long time. You'll just all be astonished out there in California to have, you know, that anyone would say this, right? But the for years and years, many of the tech folks, you know, they would like to portray themselves as not Tyrannosaurus Rex, but friendly plant-eating Brontosauruses, you know, and they would even intimate that, well, you know, maybe, yeah, we have sort of like the Brontosaurus, we got part of our brain in the tail, so we can't even quite figure out. We're just making the world wonderful. That changed a lot. It was happening in stages, and there were always folks. The usual suggestion is Peter Thiel, but there were others and more who never thought that way and were interested in defense. But from 2017 on, this changed a lot. There's no way you can separate this from the great galvanizing anxiety about China, both in the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon and environs, and in big tech. So lots of folks got interested in defense. And then the tech guys started carrying on and saying, you know what? We're wonderful. I mean, we can do all these things, you know, never mind the flying cars, but how about a really fast flying drone or something like that? So they started attacking the legacy defense producers, legacy meaning the very old folks, not all that far in Southern California, you know, to this day, and saying we can do this cheaper, better. And that market, after 2017, it took off. Then you saw, as the market in defense grew, suddenly people in Microsoft, Google, and elsewhere suddenly found, you know what, we could maybe work for defense after all. The other thing that was often an obstacle in this as a sort of completely consistent political coalition was the green side of things, where most of Silicon Valley, you know, including, you remember, Elon Musk, was running stuff saying, we're going to save the Earth from superheating.
Electric cars, all of it.
Yeah. But two problems hitting there. One was after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, all of the fossil fuel guys started quickly pushing out the line that since the cutoff of most, not all, oil and gas, but especially gas to Europe, means that we can supply it with liquid natural gas out of there. In fact, you know what? We can be the whole fulcrum of the world here. We can supply all the liquid natural gas the world could deal with. Now, Qatar and their other big producers, let's lay the details off there. And very quickly, the oil and gas folks went around saying, you know, in this new world, you're going to need us. We're a vital foreign policy point. A lot of people in the American foreign policy establishment, in finance and lots of other places, thought, you know what, that's a pretty plausible argument. Then Silicon Valley comes along, and the rising cost of the large language models, which is just enormously expensive to run. I mean, you can, you know, everybody can debate, you know, is it
expensive, not just in the construction, but also in the use of electricity and water. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're going to need a lot of that. And so what these guys lose their chlorophyll counts pretty fast. They go non-green. And they're sort of saying, we just need cheap power. You could really see huge chunks of Silicon Valley just go ungreen. I mean, the way I keep saying is the chlorophyll count drops to virtually nothing. And then you get guys making up stories like, well, first we'll get general intelligence, and then we'll figure out a way to fix it. Well, you know, is it necessary to point out in the city of Los Angeles, that's a tough claim to sustain as things barbecue and the average temperatures rise and the insurers will not be able to pick up the slack. They just walk away from it. What that's giving you is a kind of merger of defense tech. It's got foreign policy overtones, so we're not going to be able to sort through those. And then the crypto side of it, most of Silicon Valley has crypto in its DNA. Now, this is really about payment systems domination and who's going to profit from it. And they'd like to just see to it that, you know, in effect, they'd like to run it. Now, in their heart of hearts, some of these folks really think they don't need the Fed at all. They rarely say that. They think they don't even necessarily need the dollar. That was the Bitcoin enthusiast. Now, the actual practical stuff that's coming down there, it's not Bitcoin. It's not even just blockchains. Blockchains are simply one part of a complex set of highways by which you get on. The on-off ramps are pretty interesting. They're pretty expensive. And in many cases, since folks are just taking down guardrails of all types. I mean, the Trump administration closed down the crypto enforcement agency that was around and just disbanded it, along with a lot of other things. The security sides of this are really quite troubling, not least because you got quantum computing coming up. You haven't got any real defense against a really active quantum attack that somebody's able to launch if you don't have a quantum defense thing. And nobody, the people that we're a little far from that yet, but we're not that far from it. And folks got to think about it. And the administration has not, I think, done well. The federal organizations that work with that, they kind of disbanded or dialed them down and let a lot of people go in Doge and other things. So this is not a happy situation. But red tech is essentially, think of it as a kind of merger. A slide where the shade of red changes a little bit, but not a lot, from crypto, which is part of finance, with a lot of finance guys now coming in who were not part of that, thinking, hey, you know what, we can make money in here. Like most of the big banks, I've heard major bankers say, they don't really like it, but clients are, they want to be able to trade out of a bank account into crypto in and out. So you've got crypto and finance and defense. This is quite a block. It's huge. It's new. It was not there even in 2020.
And you're saying that this is, and we've seen as well when, you know, at the inauguration of Trump, you saw all the tech bosses right behind him. And this seemed new because, you know, as you already explained, Tom, they were liberals, at, you know, before that. They were green, all of those things. But it's really about money. But is it really, I mean, you're also saying it's bipartisan. And it leaves the Democrats in this impasse in the sense that traditionally Democrats are pro-labor. And for these tech giants, as you've explained, at least in the interview in Jacobin, that they see unions, tech firms see unions as obstacles in education, construction, healthcare, wherever it is, it's a bother for them.
Yeah, let's generalize this and sort of, yeah, we know nobody, no business firms like being unionized. But the issue here is much broader. It's that in the application fields, you're often confronting organized unions. You know, if you want, like, there's a tremendous sums of people now, a lot of folks trying to change the way you do Hollywood films with special effects and things where they will effectively, let's forget taking you to the Sahara. Let's just do it all
AI
studio, yeah, et cetera. When they start to do stuff like that, they bump into the Screen Actors Guild. The teachers' unions have a, they're the applicants, not, you know, it's usually the school boards, if they are unionized, are not usually heavily contesting that outside of some states where people are truly fanatics and all Republicans in the thing. But for a lot of the companies, the issues are like, we'd like to replace, I'm going to make it up, fourth grade with a sort of more individualized instruction. Now, I actually think some of this stuff can work, and people need to find a way to incorporate this stuff. There are a few halting steps on this, but the teachers, you can see these battles over private education right now. They're everywhere, and the folks, it's usually a block of venture capitalists, usually invested in this stuff. This is a really big deal, and it's much, this is to say that the, let's sum it up, this is the whole point of the Jacobin interview in just a nutshell. This is a case where the leading economic sector is now in a head-on collision with the old institutional basis of the Democratic Party.
Right.
Who's going to give? I'm not sure what's going to happen. I'm not super optimistic. You know, not all these venture capitalists are necessarily programmatically anti-union. They just say they're wrong. Reid Hoffman says he has nothing against unions qua unions, but they're just wrong on a lot of issues. That is likely very different from Elon Musk.
I mean, you described this very well in that interview, too, about, you know, the structural impasse for the Democrats. And it's really between their traditional base, working people, and now the donor class, as they're being called, who are openly directing, you know, openly saying what they want in the both political parties. I mean, we should probably leave out the Republican Party for just now. I do think that I'd like you to explain for the listeners the sort of bipartisan nature of money in politics. And also, as you're explaining it, you know, the way that it pushes both parties to the right. And in this case, it sets up this confrontation. And as you've said, you know, the traditional organizations of the working class and the communities around them, they still exist. They're around. And they're
in some places. I mean,
yeah, we see it here really and they're strong. Flexing muscles and we see it against ICE and we see all of really good resistance that's not coordinated enough at a level to make a difference. But we're talking about, like, you know, even within the Democratic Party. So how do you see this developing and what could be a counterweight?
Well, I'm not sure how. I think people have to be quite troubled by this. I usually tell people, if you want a happy ending, see a Disney movie. You know, that's a line.
Boycott Disney now.
But yeah, well, anyway. Tim Burton works for him, right? I mean, that's not helping matters from that. Maybe a gothic movie of some type. But no, I think the Democratic Party is rapidly turning into American Gothic 2, since the original American Gothic 1 was a painting. And I'm not sure how this is going to come out. I don't like what I see. You know, if you want to tell if you're getting a line or not, though, I have a very simple test. Like, you know, healthcare is just overwhelmingly important to people. Does anybody want to talk about that in a serious fashion? You need to find ways to start delivering healthcare to large numbers of people and doing it effectively. And it is true, as my colleague Philip Elvelda keeps reminding people, that there's so much money going into overhead costs, general profit distributions and such, that you could actually pay most of the frontline doctors exactly what they're being paid now, probably, and find still enormous sums if you'd cut into the surplus that goes into all the levels above that. I mean, that was an early result from the early Sanders discussions of Medicare for all. The U.S. needs right. Medicare for all. And, you know, it's like, this is crazy. That's like,
it's the cheapest, best solution, but it's anathema to, you know, this now. I mean, it's now a revolutionary demand to have it because it expropriates huge industries.
Yeah. I also don't have a problem with, like, using Mark Cuban's cheap pharma stuff. That I don't understand why controlled Democratic states don't try to push more of that stuff through right away. Because you can save a ton of money through that stuff. I'm not a blanket endorsement of everything going on there, but it's a really much better than the existing system and much cheaper. The blue state governors are, when you actually look at most of them, they're talking abundance stuff, but by abundance, they have this very funny sense of few items. The abundance they need is abundant health care more than anything else.
Right.
You need Social Security locked up. Now, they're going to ultimately have to do something. I mean, they have a federal deficit problem. They're paying way too much in interest as a result of this. So there's going to have to be a Democratic answer on that. That seems to me it's going to be a combination of taxation in the upper income groups, and it's going to be trimming in defense expenditures. We don't need all of this stuff. One thing you could do is stop trying to make enemies of more and more of the world by just acting in a sort of pretty bellicose manner. You know, I mean, we did not have a defense problem with Denmark or Greenland. Now we have Macron offering to put some French troops to help the Danes in Greenland. How crazy is this? So, I mean, now even Trump is talking about some type of understanding with China. I'm not somebody who's telling you that the Chinese or any part of the developing world is automatically peace-loving folks. That, I think, is so nonsensical. I don't know what to say. Or the BRICS as people. The BRICS are mostly run by authoritarians. But the U.S. and China need to get along. You know, I mean, we got along with the Soviet Union even. and we didn't have a nuclear war. There's just no reason why we should be constantly pointing up, you know, what do we do in the next stage of an oncoming nuclear war or something like that? That it should be possible to work that up. You're going to have to sort of trim the rhetoric on both sides to a considerable extent.
Well, I think, you know, this is another question, and we don't have time to go into it, Tom, but that is how much the trajectory of this century changed with Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And then, of course, with the Gaza war, it is redefining foreign policy and relationships. That's another discussion, but it's also related to the economy, and it's also related here to the way that both parties function and how influenced they are by, as you say, big money, big donors, and tech, which is now going into defense and other issues. To wrap up, I guess, you know, one of the things that we've always talked about the role of money in politics, but now we're seeing, you know, MAGA folks are primarying traditional Republicans, and now you're getting progressive candidates trying to primary Democratic ones. And of course, what you have is incumbents generally win again because there's no competition, even though in your reckoning, it shouldn't be the case, it seems to me, because, you know, they don't deliver. Can you just say something about that?
Yeah, well, one thing in the Democratic Party, I am very strongly in favor of direct party rules changes that would ban super PACs in the primaries. That's a private club legally. It can do what the heck it wants. And I wouldn't put up with, I mean, you guys want to make a case about national general elections? We can talk about that. But there's no reason why the Democratic Party candidate has to be selected by a wall of money, to use an old expression from France in the mid-30s. I think that is a terrific reform. They should just do it. I think you can also, I mean, there's just no writing or analysis about who the Democratic National Committee really is. I mean, it's just almost nothing on this. As far as I can tell, you know, we've had a few union members, union leaders resign from the
They're leaving, and that's
now,
what they're...
I hope it's clear from other parts of this interview, I'm not writing great assessments of all unions in this. But look, the Democratic National Committee is now mostly, as far as I can tell, dominated either by former career politicians or lawyers or business folks of one type or another. And you've got almost no ability to influence what these folks are thinking or doing. And they, you know, periodically will threaten to remind you of that in the middle of a national campaign. They could open that up. You could change the way these folks are getting there. These are, again, party rules. You know, they're not written anywhere, and they're not even, you know, they're not constitutionally protected in the sense it says no money must have the right to speak in the Democratic Party. It has the right to speak in the national thing whenever it wants to. We know that. But the Democratic Party could try to do something different. As far as I can tell, you know, the idea that Chuck Schumer or Hakeem Jeffries wants to do something different is they're just trying to find and get more. I mean, that's, you know, that's all there is to it.
Thanks so much, Tom, for being with us and for your analysis, which is essentially linking big money, tech capital, and political paralysis. And this is a subject that you are exploring always in so many different ways. And we want to, you know, come back with you on this topic, especially as we see increased tensions between the need for, let's call it, you know, labor power, grassroots power, and the domination of red tech and these interests. So I want to thank you so much for your work. Well, that was a really great conversation with Thomas Ferguson. And it really speaks to all of the important political and economic issues that we face. And this is not even with, you know, talking about Trump yet, but within the Democratic Party side. And I'm really pleased that Alan Minsky is joining me now. Alan is a former program director here at KPFK, but he's also the executive director of Progressive Democrats for America. And that's an organization that's needed more than ever right now if the Democrats are ever actually going to be able to breathe, walk, and be in the coming period. But we're also addressing you because it's the same with KPFK and Pacifica Radio. We are in our fall fund drive, and we need to raise money to support the kind of programming that you tune in to hear. So, Alan, welcome to Beneath the Surface.
It is great to be here, Susie Weissman. And of course, I'm here to encourage people to donate, to support this station, support this show. We really, 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 really need shows like this at this moment in our history. And we really need for people to recognize the way that we keep free speech alive is we all participate in supporting it. We need, look, there's a question of, you know, keeping the appearance of free speech. There's also the necessity of having an outlet where your voice can be heard, where your perspective can be heard. We can't just have a situation. Look, it's very good what happened with Jimmy Kimmel over the past few days to come back to 80% of the stations he was on previously, but it's still a major corporate platform. The kind of analysis that you hear on Beneath the Surface is the kind of information that we know the powers that be do not want disseminating across this country, okay? So we have to keep this going. The reason it is what it is because it's only supported by you, the listener. Very little government money supports KPFK, so that makes it much less vulnerable to NPR, to being shut down.
Right.
And we have no corporate underwriting, okay? Because we know the corporations are either in the pockets of the ascendant fascists in our society, or they are simply not interested in the kind of critique you hear on KPFK and on Beneath the Surface.
We call it listener-sponsored radio and not listener-supported radio. We don't have any other source of money. You know, we used to have the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but that was cut out a long time ago, and now all of the public radio stations are facing the same kind of cut. So it's a dire moment to keep this. It's not just the cuts. Either. It's also, as we all know, technology is making radio, you know, different, obsolete in some ways. So we have to protect this and keep it on the air. And we're asking you to donate today at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, and dig deep into your pockets and help keep this kind of radio on the air. And we have a few thank you gifts. For $65, you can have a mug, you can have a T-shirt, and you can be a proud sponsor of listener-sponsored radio and free speech radio, as we used to say.
818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Look, Susie Weissman's Beneath the Surface really digs into the issues that it addresses. It addresses, I would say it has a few focal points. And as with Tom Ferguson, the relationship of capital to political power in the country and around the world. And then we have the question of how left formations operate around the world. Then we also have a serious focus on U.S. foreign policy and foreign conflagrations around the world. Obviously, one of the leading shows in the country. And of course, you know, people don't know Beneath the Surface. And this is one of the ways, by the way, is the radio stations are valuable. Susie just mentioned and made reference to maybe like podcasts and why radio stations are essential. Well, this show actually gets repurposed into one of the most popular left podcasts in the country. It only happens because of KPFK, though. That's because this show becomes Jacobin Radio when the content of it is shared with Jacobin Magazine. And so 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. But without KPFK, there's no Jacobin Radio.
Right.
And so just as the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, KPFK is the home station. You need to support KPFK in order to keep these things going. See, radio stations and platform media still actually generate a good portion of what you see as digital media. And of course, they also are news gathering institutions, which all the digital media relies upon as well. And again, certainly, just if you look at the first 15 minutes of Democracy Now! Every day, it's one of the most important news gathering agencies that Americans consume around the country. We need Pacifica Radio going. We need your support to keep it going. And background and beneath the surface with Susie Weissman, there's just, I know no show in the country that has consistently looked at the macroeconomic realities of American society and the relationship of that reality to political power and democracy. This is an exemplary show in that regard with Thomas Ferguson, one of the great analysts on the subject. But over and over again, through the two decades that I've worked with Susie Weissman, there was simply no show in the world anywhere that saw the 2008-2009 market crash coming. It was almost like Suzy was Nostradamus, 2-3 years out, about the fragility of the American economy and the understanding of the weakness of capital and its incapacity to deliver for the people, and what is an alternative politics that which can deliver for the people, is addressed in the most intelligent, with the most depth of any show that I know in all of American media. There's no question why an organization like Jacobin tapped this show to become its signature podcast. So call 818-985-5735 to keep Suzy Weissman's Beneath the Surface on the air at KPFK, to keep KPFK on the air. And let me tell you know, it's time for people to get the KPFK t-shirts again. Go out and support these things around town. It'll be a show. People need to hear the station. People need to be able to tune in the morning and hear Democracy Now! People need to tune in the afternoon and hear Ian Masters, and on Sunday to hear Suzy Weissman, in the afternoon to hear John Wiener, and all the great shows all over the dial on KPFK. Sport this proudly. They have it in all your sizes, a $65 pledge, or get a coffee mug also for $65, or pledge whatever you can. If you can pledge $25, that's an annual membership to KPFK. If you can pledge $250, and by the way, maybe get, what's 65 times 5? Whatever that adds up to, that's about $325. Pledge that level. Get 5 t-shirts. Share them with your friends. Get people supporting KPFK around town, folks.
Gift t-shirts.
818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK.
Well, thanks, Alan, for all of that, but I can't echo it even more. I mean, we do not just labor, we do not just international politics with a specific concentration on Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union and Russia, and now China as well, but also labor, because that's the counterweight. And looking at, you know, the militancy of labor in the last period in a lot of depth, but also the obstacles there. And we can't do it anywhere else. Please call in and give your support. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. And as Alan says, take a t-shirt, wear it when you go on your, you know, anti-ICE demonstrations, or when you go, you know, on your No Kings demonstration.
Get one in advance of the No Kings demonstrations. It's coming up on October 18th. That's going to be massive here in Los Angeles. Sport a KPFK t-shirt. We got to get people listening to the station, folks, because this is their free speech media. It is our free speech media. It's the media we need at this dire hour in our history, where free speech is under attack like in no time I have ever seen in my life. No. And we just need independent media that we own, we control. It is our media. And again, you also get the great show Beneath the Surface with Suzy Weissman every Sunday here on KPFK Radio. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK.
Alan, thank you so much. And I can't say enough times to the listeners, this is a critical moment. It's a critical moment for the country, for free speech, for democracy, and it's a critical moment for all of the media that you listen to. We need you to really dig deep right now and give as much as you can at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Think of every dollar that you give as a dollar that defends democracy, that defends free speech, and that defends your voice. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Take that mug, buy your Christmas gifts early, and give everybody a KPFK t-shirt for a $65 donation. But please, just call in, 818-985-5735.
Thank you, Susie.
Thank you, Alan Minsky. Thanks always for coming in and helping us do this. And that's our show for today. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface. My guest was Thomas Ferguson. He's a political science and literally the proponent of the investment theory of politics that we talked about and a lot more. And thanks also to our executive producer, Robert Brenner, our producer and director, Melissa Figueroa, and our editor and engineer, Juliana Gota, and to Osman Flamenco at the controls. You can find this and all our archive shows at kpfk.org or on Jacobin Radio. That's wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and please call 818-985-5735. Pledge your support to keep this program and this radio station on the air. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Suzy Weissman.
This is Stephanie Wells, Executive Director of Pacifica Foundation. Congress has defunded public media, threatening the survival of television and radio stations that provide trusted news, emergency alerts, and vital community connection. Years of corporate media consolidation and deregulation have taken media out of community hands, while social media platforms cut back on fact-checking, leaving communities vulnerable to misinformation. In this time of social crisis and climate emergencies, local stations provide vital information for keeping our community safe. You can help by supporting and donating to your local community media. This message comes to you in solidarity from the Pacifica Foundation.
Sometimes when you listen to KPFK during a fund drive, you might feel that maybe your contribution wouldn't really be enough to make a difference. Well, let me tell you something. Every contribution is important. Whether it's a single $25 gift, installments of $25 per month, or